This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.
The young shining cuckoo is fed by its foster parents on insects and spiders. But the korimako, or bellbird, has a much more interesting diet of nectar. It's been something of a radio personality and has sung on shortwave radio to Australia and the Pacific nations for 30 years. However, the early recordings failed to reflect the versatility of the bellbird, with its wide variety of liquid notes and artistically placed clicks and bell-like sounds. It's not surprising that Maori mythology describes korimako, the bellbird, as the messenger of tane, sent to herald the coming of the sun.
Community or chaos, we can construct and nurture community or fall into chaos. Over the next hour, Marvin Hubbard hosts conversations toward creating a fairer, more equal society.
Community or Chaos is made possible with the support of Quakers Aotearoa. You'll find them online at quaker.org.nz.
Good day, friends. This morning we're interviewing Mayor Julius Raddick, and you can podcast this by going to oar.org.nz and then going to podcast, then going to Community or Chaos. Welcome to OAR Radio and Community or Chaos, Julius. Could you talk about your experience as a city councillor and then the one term so far as mayor of Dunedin?
Yes. Well, I came onto council in the beginning because I was disturbed with the way that we were going and that certain things in Dunedin were not being done. So in particular, there was scant regard to infrastructure, and I was very concerned about the beach and still am. And so those were very significant things. But the focus on having a range of nice-to-haves around the city versus the essential requirements of a city to survive.
You mentioned the beaches. Can you talk about that just a little bit?
Oh, well, one of my key things was getting, and still is, to try get the groin reinstated on St. Clair Beach, because we do have a problem with sand loss on the beach, and there's been a lot of discussion about it. And I thought I came into council thinking it would be very straightforward because there were still poles standing on the beach and it would be simply repair of an existing coastal structure. However, that was not generally accepted by the regional council, and we haven't gotten any further with repairing that structure. But that structure served a wonderful purpose, and it was, you know, we had three sets of groins over the years. From more than 100 years ago. 1902 was when the first ones went in, and those groins put an end to the constant destruction of the seawall. Our solution has been to have a stronger seawall, and erosion continues. But if you look along the beach, the coastline a bit further, you'll see Tomahawk Beach is exactly the same as it's been for the last 150 and probably many hundreds of years. There is no erosion. So it's sometimes during the winter, a bit of sand leaves, but it always comes back, and that beach is about exactly the same as it's been forever. But the seawall at St. Clair reflects the waves back out, which scours the beach, causes erosion, and the solution to that was putting groins in the water.
Well, why did the regional council reject it? It doesn't seem like a terribly expensive operation.
It's not. Well, it is my hope that we can still do it as a temporary structure, to put it in as an experiment for a period of years, and to see how it works. So I certainly haven't given up hope on that.
Okay, what's the difference between being a councillor and being mayor?
Well, the councillor gets to chair all the council meetings. Otherwise, there's just one vote for the mayor, same as councillors. But, you know, it depends how deep you want to go into, you know, the workings of council. But the mayor is also charged with trying to, you know, keeping order in the meetings, and there are many councillors that always want to test the limits of that.
Do you have for instance, when people become citizens, you often or take part in that formality of the city.
Well, that's right. So, you know, the mayor has a lot, I suppose, more community interaction. And people like the mayor to go to various openings of events and community events. So on a typical week, I will go to 3 or 4 community events. And that's been the case right through the term as mayor. I've been very open and receptive to going and opening or participating in community events. So, for instance, I was up at Brockville for the opening of a new basketball court and skateboard ramp on Saturday. And spent a couple of hours up there just, you know, talking to the people up there and watching the kids in particular make use of the facilities. And it was great to participate in that. That was, you know, one example.
What's the relationship with the mayor and the council, but more particularly the mayor and the staff of city council?
What's the staff? I missed the
staff. The relationship between the mayor and the city and the staff.
Right. Well, I only have one. There is councillors. The mayor and councillors only have one employee. That is the chief executive. So I speak extensively to the chief executive. But on the floor of the council buildings that are municipal, you know, facilities, civic centre that I'm in, there are a range of staff there, so I tend to interact with them on an ongoing daily basis, you know, and talk to key staff members about what we're doing and how we're getting on and the various initiatives that we have, because it has been a big concern of mine about infrastructure, and so I've been working with them throughout the 2.5 years and, you know, discussing things with them. They're the ones that make the decisions and implement resolutions of council, but I like to interact with them and get a good understanding of what is happening.
What's the relationship between you and the chief executive?
Well, the chief executive is council and mayor. The mayor and council is only employee, so I, you know, see her on a regular basis. You know, I talk to her in a scheduled time once a week, but also we, you know, cross paths regularly, probably most days, and, you know, discuss what's going on in the city.
In a general way, I don't want to get into specifics, but do the staff and council decisions, do they always agree? I mean, you have to make policy direction, but not necessarily specific decisions. So is there ever a tension between council and staff?
Well, as an overall thing, not so much, but certainly from specific councillors. We have a range. We have a very diverse council. So, and some of them have very divergent views. So quite often councillors will take issue with a staff decision or a direction that they don't like. But, you know, all staff decisions come as a result of council resolutions. And every 3 years, although it was 4 years in this case, but it'll be 2 years in the next case because of that, we make a long-term plan, which is the plan for the next 10 years. Currently, it was the plan for the next 9 years because we extended a year because of COVID and water. And then every year we have an annual plan, which updates the long-term plan. So councillors sit in deliberation and we have a very detailed outline of what's going to happen in the city for the next, and in the current case, 9 years. So here's the consultation document. I hope you've seen and read that in some detail about what are the key issues and changes and elements of interest within the 9-year plan. And here is a copy of the 9-year plan in its draft form for the last meeting of deliberations that council had. So there's a lot of detailed information there. So the public get to see all this, and there are many graphs and tables and charts of information explaining to the public of Dunedin exactly what's going to be happening in the next, you know, forthcoming 9 years. And there's a lot of spreadsheets and detailed financial information there as well. And, of course, the councillors get to read all that prior to deliberations and make comment on it and make some changes on it at the last minute, which happened.
I understand the mayor represents the city council, and once the city council makes decisions, you represent those decisions.
Yes.
It's in New Zealand, historically, there's nothing been unusual for local bodies to make their feelings on foreign and defense policy known. In the early 80s, every major city in New Zealand was pronounced themselves nuclear-free well before the government made that decision. Were you surprised that many city councils wish to support sanctions against Israel for committing ethnic cleansing or genocide? And how do you feel about this issue?
Well, I feel that that is an issue that we as a council shouldn't be making a key focus when we've got so many infrastructure issues that need to be focused on. I also don't think that we as a council should be asking the government to ask its own members of the government parties to support a minority opposition party's bill, because that's, you know, naturally not something that they are likely to want to do. And they are the ones who are debating as to how to interact with the world, the United Nations, and the other countries of the world, and Israel and Palestine.
I can understand how it can be difficult, but I'm sure that the government at times under Muldoon in nuclear-free zones found that disturbing as well. And sometimes people feel so strongly about something like genocide that it's hard not to try to take any action you can on it.
Well, this issue currently is a very divisive issue. And so certain members of council were very keen to make it a divisive issue for council, and council was evenly divided. And so I conveyed the results of that that vote and that debate directly to government, as I was asked to do. And, you know, that was and I conveyed it in a manner so that the people in government, the critical people who it was addressed to, could understand exactly what went down, what the feelings of the Dunedin community were. And so the council that we have represents the diverse and many diverse views of Dunedin City. So what I did was accurately convey what happened in the meeting and accurately convey the outcome of that meeting. And so the government got to see exactly what Dunedin City Councillors felt. And I think that's also a fairly accurate representation of what our community thinks.
I'm not sure about that. I think that a lot of people, some people in the community may not feel strongly about it. But I suspect that the people that do feel strongly, the majority of the people that take an active look at it, actually feel quite strongly against what's happening. And
nobody likes, the huge loss of life that is happening. And as I said in the debate, I've visited Israel and I've seen how the Palestinians are treated, and it's not a good situation at all. And I think everyone would like to see, I think people all around the world would like to see some kind of solution to this problem that has been dragging on for a very long time with huge loss of life and ongoing massacres of one sort or another. It's a horrible situation. But I don't believe that we're going to solve it from here. But I do believe that the action that Minister of Foreign Affairs Winston Peters took by aligning us with the UK, with Canada, with Australia and with Norway is actually a significant action on the world stage and will have a reasonable effect on Israel when they see an alignment of those Western nations getting together to ban a couple of politicians and take a specific action that we can actually do and make it difficult for them to travel. But we're also pointing the finger very much at the warmongering that is happening and the loss of life that is happening, and making that very clear that we disapprove of that.
Okay. Are you satisfied and happy with the active support that Dunedin citizens showed for the Dunedin Hospital build to be built on the promises that various governments have made?
Yes. And so the thing with the hospital situation is that Dunedin City Council had to represent the feelings of the public of Dunedin and the clinicians and the key stakeholders in that hospital to two successive governments. And in each case, that in order to get the right result, it necessitated a change in the Minister of Health. So both the Labor government and the current coalition government changed the Minister of Health, and then came up, in each case, the new minister came up with the right decision, which is to build the full size of the hospital as promised and figured out in a detailed business case back in 2021. But of course, it's taken a very long time to get here, and there's been a range of changes along the way. But the Dunedin public absolutely came out and supported that hospital and really demonstrated exactly how much they care. When you get 35,000 people marching in the streets, that's hard to ignore. And the each of the elements in that campaign made a difference. And, of course, the greatest difference was made by that, because that really became national news.
So are you pretty – are the staff at the hospital pretty satisfied that things will work out well for the hospital?
Well, throughout this campaign, I've communicated very directly with the representative clinicians. And so there's Professor Patrick Manning and Dr. Sheila Barney, and they are the representatives through a range of committees now, and they're very much in tune with what is happening and what is required. And, the hospital did start from a point of view of having, everybody's wish list included in the early representations. And so when you start from the early wish list and then it gets cut down to the reality of the situation and what's actually needed, we do find ourselves in a situation where the clinician representatives are not pushing back on what is happening. They can see that we're getting essentially all of the elements that were put into the plan back in the detailed business case. And bear in mind, there's been two significant reviews of the hospital since that time. So the previous government cut it down from three buildings to one, but then infilled a bit of that building, the central building. And then this government has retained that one building, but they've also infilled it a bit more to introduce some efficiencies to the building. So they've put in extra capacity in there, and they've redrawn some of the plans to take out some of the underutilized space. And what that has done is allow for the whole sixth floor to be empty at this point in time. It's still 6 years away before construction is complete. But what that has done means that there's the potential for other things to be put in there that were left out of the previous cutting down from three buildings to one.
I understand the former person in charge, Pete Hodgkin, is fairly confident now about the future of the hospital.
Yes. Yep, absolutely, I believe so.
I understand why do you think there hasn't been more support for your re-election from the council itself?
Well, there's various councillors that have their own opinions. So the two councillors that were part of Team Dunedin jumped ship very early in the piece. So, and you may have seen an article in the ODT a couple of weeks ago explaining why that was. They didn't support the groin, even though that was a key platform for Team Dunedin. And they didn't support the flexibility for George Street, even though that was a key platform for Team Dunedin. So You know, that's very disappointing for them to have changed their mind post being elected. They could have done it pre the election when it was part of our election campaign, which helped get us all elected. But, however, they jumped ship quite early afterwards. And what that's meant is that I have, well, I didn't make a fuss about it then, and I haven't made a fuss about it now. But the councillors themselves outed themselves in the paper a couple of weeks ago. And so what that shows is that the council has proceeded without hiccup over the last 2.5 years. So, I've been able to work mm-hmm. with them, carry on working with them, and we do so in a collegial fashion and get on with the job of improving the infrastructure of Dunedin.
What's the reason for some people being strongly against the Groin?
Right at the very heart of the matter, I don't understand, because to me it's an absolutely proven successful strategy, a proven successful mechanism for holding sand on the beach. However, the geographers of the world would say that it causes erosion on the lee side, but that is demonstrably not true in the case of St. Clair Beach. And that's because we've got longshore drift from both sides there, which is quite unusual in a world situation. So that would be one. And what we do see is that as the Groin has disappeared, the erosion has continued. And so the end wall effect around the end of the sand sausages continues whenever we have big winter storms and sand gets eroded. And, I think that's an untenable situation. The next step on that process is that the landfill at Kettle Park there will need to be excavated at a cost of currently projected $37 million. Whereas I started out by saying that the Groin could be built for $100,000, and I suppose with remaining poles there still sticking proud on the ground, that would have been easier and cheaper. I'm now prepared to go to $500,000 if required, and it may well be able to be done for $100,000, but we don't have an accurate estimate of the price. We certainly have local contractors who are more than happy to do it and have the equipment and expertise to do so. To me, it's a very small investment to reinstate a Groin or two or three right there in St. Clair, and in the hope that they'll still build up sand on that beach just as they did for 100 years, between 1902 and around about 2000. And it made a colossal difference to the beach, and that is very easily demonstrated from the reports of the Ocean Beach Authority at the time. And every time they repaired or reinstated the Groins, the sand built up again straight away.
Will you be doing anything else about the beach as well as the Groins?
Well, what do you mean about the beach?
I mean, is there more structures that need to be built and so on?
No, I mean, I don't want to be building structures on the beach. It's just that this beach has been built. This structure is required in response for an existing structure.
Okay.
If there was no structure, if there was no esplanade and a seawall there, you wouldn't need a Groin, just like Tomahawk, right? The beach at Tomahawk doesn't erode. Not only that, the sand that accumulates on that beach is taken away and mined, taken away and sold. And the same thing would happen at St. Clair Beach if there was no seawall. But people love the esplanade. People want to be able to stand and walk along the top of that esplanade and look at the beach. So the obvious answer, which was became obvious after three or four seawalls were smashed at the two centuries prior, about 1898 and thereafter, there was three or four walls smashed a bit by the ocean storms. They built some Groins, which built up the beach and meant that the waves didn't hit the wall anymore. And that's what needs to happen in the first instance, because I remember, and you may, that kids used to jump off the seawall. The current seawall, shortly after it was built, kids could jump off the top of that onto the sand. And that you certainly can't do it now, because the sand level is way lower. It's probably 5 metres lower.
Yes, you can notice the difference over the years.
Yes.
I'm going to play some music and then we'll come back to maybe talk about South Dunedin.
Yes.
Well, friends, we're talking with Mayor
Jules Raddick.
I might have mispronounced your last name before.
And the first name, Jules.
Jules Raddick, okay.
There we go.
And we've been talking about the hospital, but now we're going to be talking about flooding in South Dunedin and certain areas. I understand Neil Johnston, a semi-retired professional flood control and river management engineer, has been critical of what hasn't been done in stormwater pipes and other areas. Also, I'm not sure it's well known, but a lot of the water that gets into South Dunedin isn't necessarily from the sea, it's from the surrounding hills. Is that correct?
Yes. Look, Neil Johnston is correct. There's a lot of work that hasn't been done. And under this council, under my council, it is being done. And he's also quite correct. GNS Science did a lot of work and research and measurement of groundwater levels. And the water that is present in South Dunedin after heavy rain events does not come from the sea. It comes from the sky. And the issue with South Dunedin is South Dunedin is a bowl. And when you get inundation-sized storms, the water falls from the sky and accumulates on the ground. The core of the issue is there is insufficient pipes and pumping capacity in South Dunedin, and that's been known about for quite some time, and it's been barely improved. So you've got in the paper this morning, council engineers, essentially having to blame the situation on, previous councils. But, there's one of the key reasons why I came into council is to improve the infrastructure of the city. And we are absolutely on a path to do that. And as far as South Dunedin goes, we've got near-term, medium-term and long-term activity taking place. Now, working backwards from the long-term, which is climate adaption and resilience, that's the South Dunedin Future Program. And the people of Dunedin will have seen a large long-term program mapped out. And really that's, 100 years of program mapped out.
That could be confusing for local residents, can't it?
That's right.
Especially if they're already getting sewage and flooding.
That's right. So I'm coming back from the long-term through the medium-term. And the medium-term plan is the key elements of that. It's all part of Local Water Done Well, which is a general upgrade of all infrastructure, all water infrastructure right throughout New Zealand, which has been brought about by tighter regulations from Taumata Arawa. And all councils throughout New Zealand are improving their water infrastructure, be it freshwater, wastewater, stormwater. Now, in our case, we've got, there's plenty of work. We're an old city, so we've got lots of old pipes and lots of old systems. So everything needs to be improved. And, we have been working steadily on that in some areas, but we need to take some giant leaps in the medium term. And so the medium term, one of the medium term leaps that is being taken is with the Green Island Wastewater Treatment Plant. And this is specifically relating to the issues in Surrey Street.
What will you be doing at the Green Island plant?
The Green Island plant will be significantly upgraded and it will take all the wastewater from Kaikoura Valley and from Mosgiel.
How long do you think it will take before this happens?
Well, it's some years. It's going to be done progressively over the course of the 9-year plan. So that's why I call that the medium term. And then we come back to the short term. And so we've got, and then I'll go to instant. Okay. So I've got four things to tell you about. So the main problem that is worrying Surrey Street people at the moment, of course, is the wastewater that's coming from Kaikoura Valley and emerging onto the street onto Surrey Street. And so, the proper fix for that, the permanent fix for that, is to divert all of the Kaikoura Valley water to the wastewater treatment plant at Green Island. But there's a large upgrade required for that. There's a lot of pipe infrastructure required for that. It is a long-term plan. It is many millions of dollars. It's about $44 million allocated for that work. And then on top of that, there'll be other contributing works. And there's, you know, there's a lot of sorting out to be done for that. So then we come back to the short-term plan, which is addressing the floods that we had in October 24. And I said at the time, we're absolutely going to get better pumping and better piping and pumping capacity in South Dunedin to get rid of that flood water. And so three main routes, main roads, or arterial roads around the South Dunedin area, are getting new pipe provisions in them. So the number one cause of flood water, large quantities of flood water coming down to Surrey Street, is Forbury Road. The water comes off the hill behind, just as Neil Johnson talks about. The increase in impermeable surfaces on the hills above St Clair means that water rushes down off from the hills, and there's not enough capacity in the Forbury Road aqueduct to take it to sea. And so it goes across Forbury Road and down to Surrey Street. So that pipe along Forbury Road will be made twice the diameter. A new pipe will be put in twice the diameter, which gives it four times the carrying capacity. And that will exit at Seconds Beach just as it does now, except that at peak flood in October last year, that pipe was absolutely full, and so it was overflowing everywhere all the way back up Forbury Road. That pipe will be replaced with one four times the capacity. The next pipe, I'll tell you about the next two pipes, they're both significant. Hillside Road has also got insufficient flow in it, and that's really significant. And that is going to be diverted. The bottom end of that will be pumped, so that will actually create suction all the way along Hillside Road, and that pump will be pipe will be pumped directly out to sea at Arari Street. It's the stormwater pipe. And so that will really improve the flow of that. And in an early OPIS report, they said that that would improve the catchment draining capacity catchment-wide across South Dunedin by 10%. Now, the other pipe that will be improved is the pipe down Bayview Road. And so at the end of Bayview Road at Bays Junction, that will have a direct connection to the pumping station at Portobello Road. And that same OPIS report said that that improvement alone will give a 13% flood mitigation result catchment-wide. So that's the other of the three pipes and plumps, and there's $30 million budgeted early in the nine-year plan to do those works. Now I come to the instant works, because what we had a week or so ago in Surrey Street was a relatively light rain, and there was water coming through from Kaikoura Valley. The wastewater was overflowing the inspection covers right at the western end of Surrey Street and flowing out into the gutters. And so there's a range of things that we are looking at as a council, and these were all talked about last week and plans put in place to get them done. So something that will happen this week is that firstly, we'll run a video camera down the whole drain of Surrey Street to see, just in case some constriction has appeared. Maybe there's a collapse, maybe there's a problem, because it was pretty unexpected that water should be overflowing on the street then when it was relatively light. There was no flooding anywhere else, only the parks were ponding, but that was it. So that's the job one, will be to do that, to inspect that whole pipeline with the camera setup that we do have and find out if there's any constriction there. The other thing will be to investigate what other band-aids can we put on this, because the full solution, the proper solution, the long-term solution is being done, and it's funded, but it will take some years to get built, because that's Green Island, and divert all that wastewater to and through the Green Island wastewater treatment plant. We can't do that instantly. My goal is to try and get some band-aids put on this situation so that we can ensure that it doesn't happen again, and we can try and get those in place before Christmas, you know, this year. So it's only a few months, so you really need to find some relatively quick solutions. So firstly, have a look down the drain. Secondly, have a look at the various pipes that run from that end of Forbury Road down Hillside Road to see if there's any mitigating factors that we can construct or build or divert to get that water away in that direction. And then nextly, is there any other constrictions in the pipes that go down Surrey Street and then turn left into Bayview Road that can be looked at? And of course, getting the camera in there to look at it is the first thing. But then is there anything that could be constructed, could be built, that will enable that water to flow more quickly? And the third thing is, what can be done in Kaikoura Valley to divert water away? Is there any way we can take more of it to Green Island with the situation we have there? And what other things could we do? So we're looking at a whole range of mitigation measures to stop that wastewater coming onto the streets. And it's a very significant issue. It's obviously a health issue as well, but there was intense discussions. The whole team dropped everything and worked on that and is working on that. But you understand that it's not a five-minute fix, but it is, you know, a five-week fix. You know, the stuff will happen relatively quickly because and, you know, really they're Band-Aid solutions because it's not actually getting to the heart of the problem, which is the, you know, that water doesn't need to be coming through the tunnel anyway. The cyclists want to use that tunnel. They want to have a tunnels trail going through there. So, you know, we need to get rid of that pipe, get the water out of that pipe, and have it sent straight to Green Island. So that is also funded from this council into the nine-year plan.
So
there you go.
When you talk about the direction you're going, you and Surrey Street and the people pushing for change are going in the same direction, aren't they?
Well, I think so. I mean they've got a. I mean, I spoke extensively with Lynn Newell on the weekend, and I've, you know, several times I've talked to her extensively about, you know, what we're doing, and also with Julian Dory. So, you know, they have a clear idea of what we're doing, but of course, they you know, need to keep it in the public face, and they want to make sure that it does happen. They are well aware that we're doing, you know, we have the Green Island Wastewater Treatment Plant in our nine-year plan, but that's still years away. They want an instant solution. So that's why I gave you the four things. Mm-hmm. We have long-term, medium-term, near-term, and instant. And so we're working on the instant. No one was aware that we had this problem of light rain causing that wastewater inspection cover to pop. Yeah. So that is a big surprise, actually. It was certainly a surprise to me, and I believe it was something of a surprise to the Surrey Street residents. And it's of great concern, and of course we have to put some different immediate remedial actions in place, and we're working on those as we speak.
I guess one of the frustrations for South Dunedinites and Surrey Street is they've had to put up with flooding for quite a long time, and it's only been in fairly recent history that we've talked about doing something about it.
Well, that's right. It's only fairly recently I've been mayor.
But you can see the frustration.
Absolutely.
And I have every sympathy. I think some of the people that live in South Dunedin will ask themselves, well, if this were happening on Murray Hill or Roslyn, would they have had to put up with it for so long?
Look, how can anyone answer that question?
Well, of course you can't, but
that's right.
You can see how people are feeling.
Absolutely. Well, I suppose one of the differences is I happen to live in St. Clair, so I drive past the region on a regular basis, and when we've had flooding or near flooding events, I've been there and driven down and looked at everything. I photographed everything in October. I went down right to the edge of the water so I could see what is the capacity of this aqueduct at Arari Street. What is the capacity of this aqueduct at Portobello Road? What is happening with this flood water? How can we, you know, what can we possibly do to get rid of it? And what I noticed is the flood levels rose on the Thursday night, I think it was, and they dropped overnight. And then we had heavy rain again on the Friday morning. This is on October 24, and the flood levels came up again. So it was clear that the pumping system and the drains were working, but they were insufficient for our needs. They are absolutely insufficient. We need better pipes and better pumps there to be able to get rid of that water. And it's South Dunedin's a bowl. The only way we can get rid of it is to pump it out. And it's just like the Netherlands in that regard. So one of the things you notice about the Netherlands, and if you've even got an idea from visual images that you may have seen over the years, is the whole lot of windmills.
Yep.
And all those windmills were there for it to pump the water out.
Yeah,
because that's how you live below sea level, which most of them do.
The Netherlands are a model for our future.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Learn to live with the water, so make a bit more space. And one of the things we do have space is with those play fields. So one of the things in the longer-term ideas is to use those playing fields more, and in particular Forbury Park, so that we can pump water out from there. Have it all flow to Forbury Park and pump it from there. That's one idea. And that is included in the South Dunedin Future Ideas and was suggested in one of the OPIS reports in 2017.
All this costs money.
That's exactly right.
And do you have any ideas about how local bodies should raise money and can raise money? It seems to me that...
Well, back in the day, one of the things that happens with our roads is that government apportions local roads and national roads and parts and, you know, various categories in between, so that we do get some money from central government for some roads. Not all roads, but some of them. And so because there's regional and national significance for some of the roads that a lot of people use. And back in the day, I believe that what money used to come from central government, so in other words, from taxation, you know, nationwide taxation, to even out the cost of doing water work. But that is not the case at present. And so local communities have to pay for their own water works. And so we just have to fund that infrastructure, you know, ourselves, and we need to get on with the job. And the thing with infrastructure, especially vital and essential infrastructure such as flood protection, wastewater disposal, and freshwater, is that, you know, the sooner you do it, the cheaper it's going to be. So unfortunately, that is why we've had you know, substantial increases in rates. But we also don't want to have to go to 500% debt, which many communities in New Zealand have had to do. And they will be doing as they form CCOs, council-controlled organisations, to run their water. So what we've been able to do by going a bit early in is to fund the improvements in our water system. We've got a 30-year plan for doing that and keeping... after these couple of years, the rates are relatively high increases at the moment, but they will drop back down to 6%. And we'll be able to do that. We'll be able to do all of this infrastructure with that level of rates rise and without blowing the debt even further out. So we will get, we'll be able to keep within our previous, the previous agreed debt limit. And we won't be going anywhere near 500%. So, and we're keeping control and ownership of our water. So just over the course of the nine-year plan, that will save us $150 million extra debt that we would have had to go into otherwise.
You're part of the – there's a local body cooperative group, isn't there, in New Zealand?
I mean, LGNZ? Yes, Local Government New Zealand.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just a membership organisation like any other. So, and it has most of the councils, the, you know, territorial authorities of New Zealand included in it.
It's a almost a lobby group in looking after the interests of local bodies.
Well,
I don't mean it in a...
Yeah, they do a little bit of lobbying.
In a critical way, I'm saying.
Yeah,
you know,
they're
a group that tries to represent local body interests.
Yes, they do that. But they also... try and bring you know, mayors and chairs and councillors together. So we have a national conference coming up in a few weeks, and so there'll be a number of councillors, myself and some councillors will be going to that meeting and representing Dunedin. But there will be councillors and mayors and chairs from all around New Zealand going to that same meeting and have a range of presentations. And what that does is enable communities throughout New Zealand to have their representatives gathered together and discuss the situation, discuss all the various things that are going on in the world and compare notes and share best practice with each other. And as a result of our membership of LGNZ and I suppose communication with other cities, we've formed an alliance with Christchurch for our water. So, and what we're going to do between those two communities is investigate and decide on where are the best opportunities for shared services. So what are the things that we can share? So whether it be expertise, whether it be standardization of pipes and pumps, whether it be modularization of wastewater treatment plants, whether it be procurement, buying all at once, in large quantities and standardizing the sizes and shapes and so forth, so that that we get the benefit of economies of scale. And thereafter, once we get that up and running and figured out where it's, what are the best ways for us to work together, and each of the two communities, Christchurch and Dunedin, will be paying for their own water systems, but there are lots of things that we share and lots of elements that we have in common and a lot of expertise and experience that we have to share. And so, and then we'll be in a good position to be able to share that with the rest of the other communities throughout the South Island.
Okay. Now, the Local Bodies Association, do they talk about rates and fundraising, and do they look at other methods of raising local body funds?
Yeah, well, we have, Dunedin City Council has some other funding mechanisms beyond rates, which do make a difference on an annual basis. So we have some council-controlled companies that do provide a dividend to council. We have an investment fund called the Waipori Fund that does provide a dividend to council. And, various councils throughout New Zealand do have those similar mechanisms. So that is one. I personally would like central government to give us a share in the nationwide economy. So I think it would be good if we had a share, a certain portion of GST, for instance. Because one of the things that happens with central government versus local government, central government, when times are tough and the economy is bad, then their income drops. And with local government, that's not the case because rates are already figured out and it's a flat rate, so things don't drop down. But similarly, when the economy improves, rates income does not increase. And so at central government, with GST, the amount of economic activity in the country, things get tough in the world situation and a nationwide situation, their income drops. But if the country is booming, then their income picks up. Now, if we had a share of GST, for instance, then we would be in tune with the nationwide economy. And therefore, what that would mean for local authorities is that they would have a vested interest in the economy of the region and the economy of the whole country. So their focus would be on economic development would be improved, would be sharpened. They'd have a sharper focus on economic development. And to me, that is the next big thing for Dunedin, because we've had two really significant things come big issues for Dunedin in my term as mayor. So number one was the hospital, because without that hospital going ahead to the full size as it is, Dunedin would be in all sorts of trouble.
The medical school and the university and also your residents outside Dunedin.
Exactly. Well, the residents, all the healthcare for the whole region. Yeah. But beyond that, we've got a university and a polytech. We've got a dental school and a medical school. We're an education city. Education is the biggest industry in the city, and so you need that hospital, because the university and polytech don't just train doctors and dentists. They also train a whole heap of medical practitioners, physiotherapists, massage therapists, all sorts of people that are involved with health throughout the pathologists, for instance, laboratory technicians. There's lots of people that are trained at our universities that need a good hospital working. So that was absolutely central to, that was the biggest issue facing Dunedin, and it's great to get that across the line and being built to that full size, because it could have been chopped into three, and that would have been a 50-year plan instead of a 50-year build instead of a 5-year build. However, so the other big thing that came was the Three Waters debate. So the water infrastructure for all of New Zealand has been a huge debate, very contentious issue throughout New Zealand, and we have ended up in a particularly good place with retaining the ownership and control of our Three Waters assets and being able to do it in the most cost-efficient manner. And we're getting on with that job. So that is, the improvement of our infrastructure is, very much front and centre of the imperatives for this council and hopefully into the future. And so, unfortunately, you know, we have the Surrey Street problem, but, you know, there will always be problems around the city at here and here and here at different localities. But the main thing is to get those problems fixed, but also to have the overarching solution so that long term the improvements we make to our three waters system, stormwater, freshwater and wastewater, are such that we can hold our heads high. Now, if I look at freshwater, we've had zero fails over the last year in our freshwater system. So no, zero instances of E. coli. Now, you don't have to look too far away to find other communities around that don't have that record. And similarly, our wastewater is actually discharged to the sea from the Tahuna Wastewater Treatment Plant. We have primary, secondary, and tertiary treatment of that wastewater. So the tertiary treatment means that it's sterilized with UV radiation before we discharge it to the ocean. And I've seen boats out there fishing for blue cod off the end of that wastewater pipe. And I know commercial divers that have dived on it, and that water goes into the ocean clear. So it is disinfected, sterilized, and clear. And that is a far cry from what I've heard about from the same wastewater and commercial divers looking at other people's wastewater pipes. So, you know, we've got a pretty good record. And, of course, stormwater is the big issue. It has been neglected. There's no question of that. But that has stopped and plans are in place. It just they take time. But we are looking for instant Band-Aid solutions for Surrey Street.
Well, thanks a lot for coming and talking about these issues with us, because I'm sure there's quite a strong interest in it. And this will be podcast, so you'll be sent a link when this goes on air.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for having me. Thank you for the opportunity. Mm-hmm. And thank you for your questions. Because, you know, you've touched on some questions that are very important to the people of Dunedin and important to know what their hard-earned rates money is being spent on. And, I can assure the people of Dunedin that the vast majority of their rates money is spent on infrastructure, be it water or roads.
Well, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.